the Musar movement, as it's called, the Tnuas HaMusar. Just to tell you, you know, the classic svarim on the Tnuas HaMusar, as a movement, describing all the different personalities and their shitas, and a lot of maisim, is a either 4 or 5 volume work. It's been out of print for a lot of years, called Tnuas HaMusar, by a person, Rav Dov Katz. And, you know, volume one is only in Rav Yisrael Salanter, you know, like 500 pages. And then other volumes have other people, not as much, but, you know, some people only get 2 or 3 pages. But, you know, they were Talmidim or Talmidim of Talmidim. But this is really a tremendous, tremendous source. But there was another volume that was only privately printed, very, very hard to get. And this was called Pulmas HaMusar. Pulma, which Rav Katz wrote as well, Pulmas HaMusar was the great machlokes against Musar, by Kama Bakama Gedalim. And that wasn't printed as part of the set, because that, you know, that describes a kind of a bitter machlokes and fighting in Klal Yisrael, etc. So as is the derech of Bnei Yeshiva, when we were young, we all tried to get a copy of the Pulmas HaMusar, you know, just because we heard there was something out there that described all sorts of things. So whatever, you got to Matzas HaTaimon, but you know, you could find these things too. But again, it goes back to the fact, just to give one example. I mean, when it's a machlokes in shitas, that's perfectly fine. There's nothing to. But the problem is that sometimes it was even violence. I mean, there were, as I indicated, in Volozhin and in the yeshivas after Volozhin, the Bnei Torah were much more assertive than they are today. And if they didn't like a Rosh Yeshiva, you know, they would sometimes do physical things to establish what it is they wanted. Of course, that's gufa ra'ah, you need musar. And they say Rav Leib Chassman, who was one of the Gedolei Mashgichim, he came to Eretz Yisrael, he was a Mashgiach of Hebron, but he was a Mashgiach in Europe, and he was a Mashgiach of Tells. And a lot of the ultra bachrim in Tells did not want Musar. So in the middle of the Shmuz, like, they extinguished all the lights, and if it was candles or electricity, whatever they had then, and they like threw a bag over him, and they you know, they kind of carried him out of the Beis Medrash. But Rav Lazer Gordon, who was the Rosh Yeshiva, very, very chush of a person, was, in so in a sense, he said that if the Bachram are not Maida, if they don't ask Mechila, he says he will close the yeshiva. He says he will not have a yeshiva where Bnei Torah behave that way. Yeah.
I was just going to ask about that's rather much
besides the Tom Koch. Yeah, yes, it is. Yeah, it is. It is. It is. And Avada, there's no hedger for it. But sometimes, as the Gra said, I told you the word of the Gra, that Torah is compared to water. The Gra writes that just like water, whatever you pour on ground, the water will cause to grow. If there's poison, the water will be matzmiach the poison. The Gra says, phenomenally, that if a person has midais that are mushchasais, the Torah will make him worse. That was the site of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, actually, and that Indian. And l'chayr, some of these maisim are prove it, actually. One cannot justify that behavior. Rabbi Chassman happened to have been a big Talmud Chacham. Anyway, yeah.
What is the Chofetz Chaim said?
No, the Chofetz Chaim was a very big chassid of Musar. The Chofetz Chaim said, the Feirish, that any yeshiva that does not have Musar, he used this, he said as the following, is a bor birshus harabit. A bor b'shus harabim, right, is a big hole in the middle of a public place which will damage, destroy people. And he said it's a bor b'shus harabim. Chofetz Chaim was a very big proponent of Musar. On the other hand, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, Rav Chaim Brisker, was not in favor of it, because he felt Taira alone will be miyasher a person. Okay, you know, there were different teachers. The Chazon Ish, you know, I told you the Chazon Ish. The Chazon Ish was, of course, much later. The Chazon Ish said he is against the Musar movements, but he's more against the people who are against the Musar movement, which actually makes perfect sense. In other words, the Chazon Ish is not against Midos. No Gadol says, oh, I don't, you know, I'm not into Midos. I mean, nobody's against that. But the Chazon Ish felt if a person learns Torah with the right Kavanah, that will produce a person of great, great midas. So the Chazon Ish says, I didn't think Musar was a necessary chelek of the yeshiva derech, but if the misnagdim are behaving without derech eretz, I'm more against them than I am against the yeshivas. So what we were doing last week, we spoke a lot about Kallenberg. I want to talk about Rabbi Yisrael's main Talmidim, each of whom had somewhat of a different Shita. The senior and Talmud who was most involved in spreading Musar was Rav Simcha Zissel Breide, who was called the Altar of Kelim. And he started basically a yeshiva katana that then, you know, then you could stay on and become a kailo, yeshiva and a kailo, which was called the Talmud Torah of Kelim. And this was really the garden out of which all the great Balei Musar came. Rav Yerucham of Mir, Rav Chaska Levenstein, Rav Dessler, many, many, it was, again, not directly from the Altar of Kelim already, but Rav Yolapian. But Kelim was by far the greatest breeding ground of the people who became the Gedolei Musar. And the Altar of Kelim Shita was, we gave a lot of examples last week, was about discipline, self-mastery, not allowing your emotions to control you, to be a shaylet on yourself, to be able to understand that no matter what happens in life, our achrayas is to be calm, not to be turbulent, and to behave with derech eretz, no matter what the situation. Because of this, he even did things that we might regard as a little little strange, but he put the guys through exercises. You had to get up in the middle of the night for a 5-minute seder, and that teaches you the chashivas of zman. Because you can't just say, oh, it's only 5 minutes. The seder was over after 5 minutes. You weren't allowed to learn more. It's interesting. That was the concept. If there's a noise in back of you, you don't look around in the middle of Seder to see what's going on. Because you're focused on this. Right? After a tinus, you eat fish with bones in it. Why? Because the teva of a person is they want to eat a lot because they're hungry. You learn that, no, you have to take your time. You got a package from home or a letter from home, you wait 24 hours before opening it. What's the purpose of all this? The purpose of all this is that a person should learn to be shaylet over himself. And the person learns that every decision in life is I ask myself, what does the Eibishter want me to do right now? So I don't act because of my moods, because of my feelings. It is said that the Altar of Kelim was able to reconstruct at the end of every day every single thought, every single machshava he had during the day. Because there was not even a single machshava that was not a cheshvan ahead of time. Now the Altar of Kelim did believe in what we might call tricks. It is said that he had a certain red kapata that he called his anger a kapata. And he was makabal on himself. He would never express anger until he put on this red kapata. That's, you know, people say, even say, count to 10 or whatever it would be. And immediately he says something, first anger, but it would have to go, you know, by the time, you know, you put on the kapata already, you know, the moment of anger is already gone, right? These were all the exercises. Everything was cheshvan, discipline, yishuf hadas. But again, I hope you understand that yishuf hadas, you see, some you might think that the idea of discipline is to kind of be obsessive compulsive and anxious, but that's the other prong of it. It's a disciplined cheshvan, but in calmness, serenity, yishuv hadas. Not to be in a matzav of behola. This was his great shita in Musar. And that way, a person, practically, a person could, no matter what happens in life, he'll know a gamzul l'tov, he'll be able to ride with it. And spiritually, every decision is based on avdas of Hashem, and it's not based on convenience or ease or how I feel today. Right? A certain notion of consistency. You know, there's an interesting medrash. The Hakdama of the Ein Yaakov brings a medrash. It's a very famous medrash, but it's also an unknown medrash that nobody knows where it is. We can't find it. The Ein Yaakov quotes a medrash that nobody can find. So it's a lost medrash, apparently. And that is, you know, Rabbi Akiva says, V'yahavta l'reacha kamecha, is Zeh Klal Gadol B'Torah, right? That's the most important principle of the Torah. And Ben Azai says another thing is more important. Zeh Sefer Toldos HaAdam, that man is made B'Tzelem Elokim. That's even more important. That is in the Teres Kayanim. Those two deyas are in the Teres Kayanim. But the Ein Yaakov brings a third Mandi Omer that says that the most important pasuk in the Torah is Esakeves Ha'echad Taseh Babayker V'Esakeves Hasheni Taseh Ben Arabayim. That every day you bring a Korban Tamid in the morning and you bring a Korban Tamid in the afternoon. That's the most important. So everyone has a problem. I mean, it's a mitzvah, granted, but what makes that pasuk such a yesaitis dika klal? So the Bali Musar said, because the idea of tamid is you stick with it. Every day you do what you have to do. You don't kind of say, yeah, today I don't feel like it. And the emes is that notion of tamidius or ikvius, consistency, is even greater. I mean, let's say some guy learns, like, you know, today I'm going to learn 18 hours a day, and tomorrow I'll take off. The Alter of Kelm says, nope, it's much better to learn, let's say, even 6 hours, 6 hours, than kind of all or nothing. A person shouldn't live their life in an all or nothing, because that's a certain wildness. That's not a siddur. And that's why in Kelem, they were makbid on many things. They were makbid on dress. They were makbid on the dormitory room. You had to make your bed. These were very, in a way, it's almost like a boarding school. But the Alt of Kelem was extremely makbid in this. That this idea of seder, of chitzainius and panemius, that the seder of your chitzainius is mashpia on your panemius. Right? He was very, very makbid on these in Yonim, that maybe we think today are not such a big deal, but he considered them to be very, very pivotal in being mashlim a person. Yeah.
Did that cause some guys after they left yeshiva to do the opposite?
Well, one could imagine that. One could imagine. Remember, I mentioned Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky spent 6 months in Kelem as a bacher, and he said everybody should go to Kelm for 6 months, but then he said, but no more. I mean, you can see that even for someone like Rav Yaakov, it was a little too much. Not everybody could go with Kelm. Kelm was a tough
place. From Kelm that saw going on off there?
Very, very few. I believe not. I actually believe that Kelm taught a certain hanhaga that really stayed with you. Other yeshivas produced, you know, people who went off the derech. Kelm actually, I don't think did. So, and this is the story, you know, they say the story about Rav Simcha Zizel, that he went to visit his son in the yeshiva. I don't know if it was Voloshin or what yeshiva it was. And he traveled a long way, and all he did was check his dormitory room, or whatever the equivalent was, his lodging. They didn't necessarily have dormitories, but that he stayed in people's houses. And if everything was Masudr, he says, I know my son is learning, because the room is clean. Well, personally, I would have difficulty. I hope I wouldn't be judged by that standard. But anyway, but be it as it may, this was his shita. His shita was that person has to be very, very masudr in life. Right? So this is Kelm. So Kelm tried to be mashlim the personality in this way. Just to give you an example, Rav Elio Lapian, you know, lived into his late 90s. Baruch Hashem, he was going to be a zaken, and he was a mashgiach for, I mean, till the very end. And one time he was in Yerushalayim, and he was learning Mishnayos, waiting for a bus. And, you know, all of us have been there. The bus is late, you know, you're running after a while, you're wondering, where's the bus? So we're always looking, you know, we're looking up to see the bus. So at one point, like, the bus was 25 minutes late, he looked up from the Mishnayos just to see if the bus was coming. And then he started crying. He says, I see I'm 95 years old, and I haven't learned the lessons of Kelem. He says, what am I looking? The bus will come when it comes. What exactly? I'm impatient? I mean, if the bus isn't here yet, then it's the Ratzon Hashem that I learn, or whatever it is. Like, what am I looking at? And he was mamish crying, and he felt that he was losing all the madregas that he got from Kelem, not to kind of look around. So he was mochiach himself in a very, very stark way. So this was Kelem. Now, we then move to the altar of Slobodka. Now, the altar of Slobodka, Rav Nosson Zvi Finkel, was not a Talmud of Rav Yisrael Salanter, although he met Rav Yisrael Salanter. In fact, Rav Yisrael Salanter was much beyond him to devote his life to Torah. But the altar of Slobodka's primary Rebbe was Rav Simcha Zizel, although they had Chilukei Deis later. The altar of Slobodka's past is totally unknown. We know nothing about him before the age of 30. There is some intimation, Me'achirei HaPargut, that perhaps he was Nimshech to Haskala in the early years. But he was known as a very talented public speaker. And Rav Yisrael Salanter encouraged him to be a Maggid, who would kind of teach Musar and to people. But eventually he felt he needed to be mashlim himself more. He was not a product of a legend. In fact, we don't know exactly what those early years were at all. It's kind of a big unknown. And Bechlal, the altar, was a very, very private person. Even though he was involved with thousands of people all the time, like nobody knew anything about him. And that's why he signed himself Tzofen. Tzofen is reversed. Nason Tzvi Finkel. Tzadik is Tzvi, and Pei is Finkel, and Nun is Nason, and Tzofen means the hidden one. So that's why his svarim that were published of his maimorim after his death are called Or HaTzofen. It's not Or HaTzofen, which means the light of the north. It's Or HaTzofun, the hidden light. Nason Tzvi Finkel. Now, Rav Nosson Tzvi Finkel was actually the miyaseit of the great yeshiva in Slobodka in the 1880s. And that great yeshiva, it was called Knesset Yisrael. It was named after Rav Yisrael Salanter. And Rav Nosson Tzvi Finkel was not the Rosh Yeshiva. He was not the Mashgiach. He actually had no job in the yeshiva at all. He was just the altar, the old man, the mysterious power behind everything. But he had no official position in the yeshiva itself. But he was the main kayach in so many people who became gedolim of the later generations. He was like a father to Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, to Rav Aaron Cutler, to Rav Reuven Grozovsky, to Rav Yitzchak Kuttner, to Rav Yaakov Yitzchak Ruderman, my Rosh Yeshiva of Ner Yisrael. He was their father. They treated him. In fact, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky used to say that people say, why don't Misnagdim have a Rebbe like Hasidim? He says they absolutely had a Rebbe like Hasidim. This was the altar of Slobodka. But the altar of Slobodka, it is said, was Miyased, his 50 years of Chinuch, on the very first shmuz he heard from the altar of Kelim. And the altar of Kelim shmuz was on Godless Adam. And that became the dominant shita in Slobodka, which emphasized the greatness of a person, the kochos of the neshama, the fact that a person has so much koach that Hashem put into you to become great, to become a gadol, not to be small-minded. So unlike Kelim, which was about discipline and self-control, Slobodka was much more about creativity, autonomy, individuality, exploring what you were capable of. So you had Iluyim that were kind of little kids, like Ravaran comes at 13 years old and kind of, you know, used to stand on a table and shout kashas to the Rosh Hashivas, you know, he couldn't even reach, etc. Now that's why, as I mentioned, Slobodka produced both the Gedolei Hador and a lot of apikorsim, kind of like Volozhin, but it was a Musar yeshiva. The altar was very makbid in Musar, and he used to give two shmuzin of an hour and a half time. He gave three, you know, an hour and a half shmuz and that. But the altar was a very, very complicated person because he was always contradicting himself, but deliberately, with a cheshbon. Just to give you an example, Rav Yerucham, the Mashgiach of Mir, was a Talmud of the altar of Slobodka. And he used to come back to Slobodka. And my Rosh Yeshiva says he remembers the altar was screaming at Rav Yerucham. The whole yeshiva heard it. He was screaming at Rav Yerucham because he said Rav Yerucham was making people, I guess he didn't use the word clones, but he says, you're just teaching everybody to be like you. And he was screaming at him. He says, you know, you're not focusing on people's individual kavanos. You just want to mass produce people like you. My Rosh Yeshiva said that if he would ever talk to any bachur in the yeshiva, the way the altar of Slobodka was talking to Rav Yerucham, who was already a mashgiach of Mir, he says his yeshiva would close down in a day. Every single person would leave. But Rav Yerucham was makabel the musar. But then the altar honored Rav Yerucham to give a shmuz to Slobodka, and the altar was crying during the shmuz how beautiful it was. You know, all sorts of things in which, like, he'll give like the strongest criticism, as if to say, you're worth nothing. And then he would listen to the Torah and say, there's nothing as beautiful as what you're saying. And this was the constant idea that, you know, the people he really cared about, he gave shtark mussar to. And the people he didn't care about, he would sometimes leave alone. So if the altar was letting you do what you wanted, you were very concerned. You would say, that was the biggest mussar. What chait have I done that the altar is not mochiach me? And he had all sorts of cheshbainas. He had cheshbainas. Sometimes he would not bring up something till 10 years later. Because you had to reach a certain madrega to absorb the message. So they tell a story that the altar used aliyos to kind of indicate what a person's matzav was. He would determine the aliyos. So apparently, it was a strange system. Apparently in Slobodka, the way it worked is who got shalishi was kaiveya, the significance of every other aliyah. That if a Beinoni guy got shlishi, that means that anyone who got an aliyah that day was kind of on the downside of things. If a chashuv person got shlishi, then the other aliyahs had a certain chashivas as well. So there was a maisa about a very, very chashuv person who had been in Slobodka for many years, and he got revi on a day when shlishi wasn't chashuv. So that's kind of a double whammy. You know, it's revi, and although maisa, by the way, the rush was makbid, they all bedafka take revi, because unfortunately revi has the reputation as the least significant aliyah, because it's after, but again, there's no such thing really, but people have this idea. So the rush was makbid every Shabbos to get revi. But be it as it may, Slobodka, the altar would use this as a way of giving people mussar where they were holding that week. So a person went to the altar and said, What aveira did you find in me? Like, why, you know, I mean, I don't have to have an aliyah, but if you give me an aliyah and you put it that way, it's kind of a simon, there's something I have to be misakim. So the altar said, you're so worried about your kavod, and you don't care about mischabed b'klein chaveira. Mischabed b'klein chaveira means you get honor when somebody else is shamed. So he says, I don't understand, what maisa is the Rebbe referring to? The altar said, you don't remember what happened 10 years ago with Rav Reuven Grzevsky? So this was the maisa. The maisa was Rav Reuven Grzevsky, who later became Rav Shiva of Torah V'das. And Rav Reuven was Rav Baruch Baer's, Leibovich's son-in-law. Rav Reuven, of course, states it was a great, great masmit. And once he runs into Slobodka on a Shabbos morning, and because he's a little for tumult and learning, he takes off his jacket and rolls up his sleeve as if he's about to put on tefillin. Kind of an instinct, you know. So the altar told this person 10 years before, go and tell Rav Reuven that it's Shabbos. So the person went to Rav Reuven and had a little smile that he's telling Rav Reuven, you know, don't put on tefillin today. The altar noticed the smile. And 10 years later, he said, you're mischavein b'klein chaveirei. You get pleasure from somebody's bizayin. He says, you don't need a chashav aliyah. And the altar was doing this all the time. I mean, all the time. So, very, very... I mean, to us, it seems like a very difficult type of relationship. But the people loved him. They loved him. They loved him. I mean, he would... You know, they say he fasted. He would fast that people shouldn't be yotzei l'tavos ra. They would live in his house for months and months and months. When he was talking to Talmidim and his son, Rav Lezer Yudel, came home. And the Rebbetzin would say, why don't you talk to your son? He says, I'm talking to my other sons right now. They're my sons also. And they had this unique relationship to him. My Rosh Hashiva said over, just one out of many things, that there was a great, great Eloi who wanted to start his own yeshiva. And he wanted to attract the greatest Eloyim from Slobodka. So my Rosh Hashiva went to the altar and said he wanted to go to this yeshiva. Now, the altar understood that because this Rosh Hashiva was kind of a wild genius, he would not really give the Bachrim the hadracha they need in Musar and the like. So he told the Rosh Hashiva, what do you see outside the window? And he said, I see the river. Slobodka's on a river. He says, well, you have a choice. If you want to commit suicide, you can jump into the river now. Or if you want a slower process, go there and you know, you'll have suicide after, you know, spiritual suicide after a few years. And kachave, that all of the people who went to this Zeiloi were Yaitse Latarbasra, you know, and the like. At the other side of the coin, the Altar Slobodka was the one who really disseminated Musar to all of the yeshivas, because Slobodka was very, under because of him, was very, very generous in sending guys to be Mechazik yeshivas. And they would go for a Zman or for a year. Slutz was a great yeshiva, founded by 14 Bachar of Slobodka. Mir was an old yeshiva. Mir was older than Slobodka, but Mir became a great yeshiva by the Slobodka Talmidim who went to Mir. Rav Yeruchim was, as I say, a Talmud of the Altar of Slobodka. He was the great Mashgiach of Mir. And therefore, Slobodka was very into not only being Mechazik Torah in many, many places, but also through the Altar's influence, it spread the ideas of Musar in all of these yeshivas. Many of the Mashgichim are both from Kelim, but also from the Altar of Slobodka at the same time. But as I say, although the Altar of Slobodka was a Talmud of the Altar of Kelim, but his emphasis was on Godless Adam, and as a result, the Musar of Slobodka is a bit more philosophical than Kelim. Right? Kelim will say, you know, be a good person and be disciplined. In Slobodka, they try to be more creative in terms of Mamori Chazal, Midrashim, and the like. It's a more intellectual, like, if, for example, if you look at the Pachad Yitzchak, which is not an easy sefer, Rav Putner's writings, is an example of a Slobodka type of complexity. The Altar of Kelim did not do it that way. The Altar of Kelim was trying to stress direct working on your midos without going into, you know, with this we could be miyashiv, this kasha. You know, the Altar of Kelim was not into, with this yisod, we can for you know, the stira and Rabbeinu Yaina. That was not the Kelim approach. They thought that was using pilpul instead of musar. But in Slobodka, they used some of more of a yeshivisha way of approaching things. Yeah.
What would you call the musar of Kelim?
We're simplifying. You know, these things were not pure typologies. Obviously, the concept of Godless Adam was learned from Rav Simcha Zissel. So Kelim had Godless Adam, but Kelim was about shalita on yourself, akoveh shesitra, kavisha sayetzer. Slobodka was Godless Adam. So Kelim taught you how to discipline yourself. Slobodka taught you how to liberate yourself. So again, these are simplifications. Slobodka was about, you know, freeing yourself from the bonds of smallness, and Kelim is about the notion of having to learn how to control yourself. You need both, of course you need both, but the question is always which aspect was emphasized. Now, I'll tell you what. Yeah.
What was the husband of the Altar doing that good all in public and like having everybody?
Well, once again, you know, and I know I keep on coming back to the same point, but the Haskalah was such an all-pervasive, destructive force in Eastern Europe at the time that really everything is about how do we keep these Bnei Torah in a life of not only of learning, but even a life of Shmiras HaMitzvahs. When college beckons, universities, careers, all these things. And the Altar of Slobodka was convinced that people have to know that the life of Torah allows them to be creative and individualized and use their brilliance and use their talents, as opposed to kind of telling you you have to be mitzamtzem yourself and you're not able to develop yourself. So in many ways, he felt that Godless Adam was a key. And I should also emphasize this. In effect, the Altar of Slobodka held that Godless Adam also leads to self-control. Because the concept is, if you regard yourself, if you're makir your chashivas, then you're not going to dirty yourself by doing things that are bizayim. So instead of saying, I'm not going to do an Aveira because, you know, it's a bad thing to do, you say, how can I do an Aveira? I'm a Ben Melech. Ben Melech doesn't do pachasdika things. See, it's a different way of looking at it.
I guess it's giving Taifacha in a public form.
Yeah, well, the Altar had, again, even Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky said, the Alter had cheshbonos that we don't understand. The Alter only did it when it was a tayelis. The people who got it that way, as I say, the people who, you know, were not on the Madrega, he didn't bother. And the people like, who were on the Madrega, they took it and they understood, and they grew from it, and they knew that it came from love. In fact, even things like somebody went over to the Alter, one of these public outbursts, and said, "Rebbe, Yilamdenu Rabbeinu, I can't question what you do, but I just want to understand, Hamalbin Pnei Chaveiro, is there an inyan of not being Malbin Pnei Chaveiro?" So the Alter said, "What? He thinks I'm Chavera?" Was he, like, again, very, sometimes very, very sharp. He says, "Who does he think he is? Chavera? You know, your Rebbe is Chavera?" Yeah, different, you know. But as I say, this did not, you have to understand this, this did not come because he got angry and he lost it. For carrots. This was cheshbon out. I mean, the Alter may have perhaps thought 10 years before he would do something like this sometimes. But he thought, and he was looking for the optimal way to reach that person. And sometimes these were extreme ways. And sometimes I'll be pure halacha, you know, maybe I can't defend it 100%. I don't understand. We're not on the Madrega. But all I want you to know is, this was not somebody who, God forbid, was simply losing his temper. That was not it at all. These were cheshbonos that took years with Tanesim and Tfilas, and then the Alter made a decision what was the best way to be mashpia on somebody. And as they say, if you were not a Baruch, if you were not on the Madrega, you didn't get that type of treatment. A Stam guy who wasn't doing well would not get yelled at Barabim. That was not the Hanaga. It was Badafka, Rav Yeruchim, I mean, people who were Gedalim, who sometimes got that treatment. Now, I'll tell you a story. During the Alter's time, who were the Rosh Yeshivas of Slobodka? So Slobodka had two main Rosh Yeshiva, who happened to be brothers-in-law. They both married daughters of an almana, of the Frank family. One was Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer, and one was Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein. And they were the two Rosh Yeshivas of Slobodka. Rav Isser Zalman eventually, he was Rav Avraham Kapper's father-in-law. Rav Isser Zalman eventually went to Slutsk and started yeshiva in Slutsk with the Alter's blessing. And Rav Moshe Mordechai was left as the main Rosh Yeshiva. But these were great, great gedolim. I'll tell you an amazing story about Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer. Rav Shach tells this story. This is an amazing story. That the Alter asked Rav Isser Zalman to be Rosh Yeshiva. And he said, he didn't initially think about Rav Moshe Mordechai as the second Rosh Yeshiva. He says he wanted Rav Aaron Cohen, who was a very chashuv of a person, to be Rosh Yeshiva. So Rav Isser Zalman said, "You know, I cannot be Rosh Yeshiva if Rav Aaron Cohen is Rosh Yeshiva too. I can't be with him." So the Alter says, "Do you think Rav Aaron Cohen is not Roy for the position?" He says, No. There's nobody who's greater than him. He's wonderful, Rosh Yeshiva. I just can't be Rosh Yeshiva with him." He says, "Do you have a machlokes? Do you have a fight?" He says, "No, I can't have a fight." So the Alter says, "I don't understand what the problem is." He says, "Here's the problem. My mother-in-law is a widow, and she married off her daughters to great Talmidei Chachamim. And at some point, one of her daughters was a meshudeches to Rav Aaron Cohen. But my mother-in-law broke off the shidduch. Why is this?" Now, this is a strange story. Because when my mother-in-law was working in the store that belonged to her husband, Rav Aaron Cohen came in to help her one day in the afternoon when business was very busy. So my mother-in-law said she promised her late husband that she would only get Talmidei Chachamim who were holding and learning. And if this guy comes in and helps me in the store for 3 hours in the afternoon, you know, he's not right. So instead, Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein was taken. But now what's going to happen is Rav Aaron Cohen becomes Rosh Yeshiva of Slobodka, and Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein might have to go into business. And my mother-in-law is going to come in and see how I'm doing, and she'll see the one that was supposed to marry one of her daughters, but the shidduch was broken off. He's now Rosh Yeshiva. It's going to cause her so much agmas nefesh and tsar that I cannot be in this yeshiva if Rav Aaron Cohen gets the position, because it's going to cause my mother-in-law. Do you understand? It starts a little complicated. So because of this, he said, I can only come if my brother-in-law of Moshe Mordechai Epstein is Rosh Hashiva. Now, Rav Shach said on this story that this is a story that's roy for the Rishonim. I mean, I lamaisa have some difficulty with the story, because essentially what it means is Rivzer Zalman, you know, took away Rav Aaron Cohen's job. But okay, but lamaisa, he didn't say that. He didn't say don't give him the job. He just said, I cannot work under the, you know, in that matzav. You know, if the altar wants to make Rav Aaron Cohen the Rosh Hashiva, Rav Aaron Bax, that's fine, but I can't. So this is the story. So you can understand a little bit why the altar, when Rav Isher Zalman was the altar patered Rav Isher Zalman from Musar. He said, a person like you don't have to learn Musar. Your midos are enough. And in fact, Rav Isher Zalman, when he was nifter, people said, he was nifter in the 50s, people said about Rav Isher Zalman, this is an amazing thing, that if he would not have known any Torah at all, he still would have been the greatest Yid in Yerushalayim. They said that the tzidkus of his midos were so phenomenal that alone would have made him a Gadol HaDor. Rav Shach said that, by the way, by Rav Chaim Eiser as well. Rav Shach said about Rav Chaim Eiser that Rav Chaim Eiser's very metzias was a Kiddush Hashem. Besides the fact that he was a genius, that he knew Kol HaTorah Kula, that he could paskin any Shaila Nogeya Klal Yisrael. But Rav Shach says, the Sefer Panim Yafos, the way he spoke to everybody, says that metzias was a Kiddush Hashem. Says, now, in a way, it's misleading to say apart from his Torah, because of how his Torah made it that way. But he says, but even if you wouldn't have known the degree of his Torah knowledge, that itself would be a great, great madrega. So anyway, Rav Isher Zalman of Moshe Mordechai were the Rosh Yeshiva. Rav Isher Zalman went to Slutsk, and eventually Rav Isher Zalman came to Eretz Yisrael. And he became Rosh Yeshiva in Yeshiva Seitz Chaim, which is the oldest yeshiva in Yerushalayim. And he introduced the Slobodka Yeshiva Shel Litvish Derech into Eretz Yisrael, which had not really been the prevailing Derech here. And that's Rav Isher Zalman. And he was Nifter in, I think, 55, 54, etc. But Moshe Mordechai Epstein and the altar also didn't stay in Slobodka. Eventually, they moved to Eretz Yisrael. And they started the Slobodka Yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael, and the Slobodka Yeshiva moved to Chevron, and it became known as the Chevron Yeshiva. That was Knesset Yisrael. And in the 1920s, after the great Arab massacre in the Chevron Yeshiva, the Chevron Yeshiva moved to Yerushalayim, which is why Yerushalayim has a yeshiva that's called the Chevron Yeshiva. Now it has two branches, as you know, the older branch is in Geula, the other one is in Givat Mordechai. But the Chevron Yeshiva, in fact, is the Slobodka Yeshiva at Eretz Yisrael. And as I say, the altar was here, the altar was Nifter here, and Moshe Mordechai was Nifter here. And there were other Rosh Yeshivas who were with Slobodka until the Holocaust wiped it out. Now, just to give you a little fact here, after the altar and Rav Moshe Mordechai came to Eretz Yisrael, so there was still Slobodka in Europe, and there was Chevron here. The Holocaust wiped out, of course, Slobodka in Europe. So after the war, a Slobodka yeshiva opened up in Bnei Brak. So that's why in Bnei Brak, there's a Slobodka yeshiva, and in Yerushalayim, there's the Chevron yeshiva. But the Chevron is the original Eretz Yisrael branch of Slobodka, and Slobodka is what happened after the Shoah, after the Holocaust, and they're not connected in any way. Although obviously the Rosh Yeshiva are Talmidim of Slobodka. Yeah.
Is the altar buried?
The altar is buried, I believe, in Har HaZeisim. Yeah, the altar was Nifter before 1948, and in those days Har HaZeisim was the main Mokum of Kvura. Rav Moshe Mordechai's, they're buried next to each other there. Rav Isher Zalman, I believe, is buried in Har HaMenuchas. And happened to Rav Aaron Cutler is buried next day. Rav Aaron Cutler was Rav Isher Zalman's son-in-law. Yeah.
What happened to
Kelm? The Holocaust. Kelm remained as a Maisad of Torah until 1940s. And Rav Dessler writes, Rav Dessler was already in England. Rav Dessler left, was out of Poland before the Holocaust. But Rav Dessler writes that he writes about how the Talmidim of Kelm went to their death al Kiddush Hashem. And consistent with the Altar of Kelem's teachings, who was no longer alive, the Altar of Kelem, they went with serenity, with dignity, with silence. Nobody was crying or screaming, whatever it is. They just understood that just as they lived their lives al Kiddush Hashem, they are now going to give their lives for Kiddush Hashem. And this was a chelik of avodah. Rav Dessler writes very movingly because he lost many, many family members in the massacre of Kelem and the like. All the yeshivas, all the yeshivas were in Europe until the Holocaust. And then, Mir moved around. Mir, of course, was in Shanghai during the war in Japan. And then they have a branch in Eretz Yisrael. And the branch is different. The big one is in Eretz Yisrael. And then they have the yeshiva in New York, right? These are the things. Okay. Say again? No. Kelm never... That's right. Kelm never established a branch. Kelm was Kelm, just like Volozhin was Volozhin, and it didn't get replicated. Kelm was not known. I mean, obviously in Kelm they learned, but Kelm was not known as a place where you went for a derech in learning Gemara. I mean, obviously they did, but Kelm was not mefursim for that. Kelm was mefursim for the hadracha in Musar. So, as yeshivas, you didn't really have a Kelm yeshiva that got established. And there was also maybe less of a need because the Musar of Kelm was permeating all the other yeshivas, but admittedly in a very attenuated way. I mean, you're not going to find today yeshivas that, will give you fish with bones after a tainus and don't allow you to open up a letter. First of all, Kelm, by definition, works with younger people. I mean, you can't really tell a 25-year-old person, don't open that letter from your parents for 24 hours. I mean, it was more; those things were more for high school, for kids of younger age. Yeah. So it was Rav Isaac Scher, Rav Yitzchak Isaac Scher, who was the one of the Alter's sons-in-law, and he was also a great Baal Musar and a great Baal Machshava, and you could actually find sichos from Rav Isaac Scher. The Mashgiach of Slobodka after the altar left was Rav Avram Grodzinski, someone that maybe you didn't hear, but you might be familiar with his son-in-law, who was Rav Shlomo Volba. So Rav Shlomo Volba's son-in-law was the Mashgiach of Slobodka after the altar of Moshe Mordechai left, Rav Avram Grodzinski. Yeah.
How long did the Slobodka
So it depends. I mean, someone like Rav Yaakov, remember, Slobodka also had a very great kailo. The Slobodka kailo was the first kailo in Europe. The first kailo in Europe was Slobodka kailo.
You learned it your whole life?
Usually not. But people may stay there 10, 20, or even 20 years. Rav Yaakov was connected to Slobodka for 20 years. But then people took Rabbanus. I mean, you have to understand that a Rabbanus in Lithuania wasn't like a Rabbanus in America. A Rabbanus in America kind of means, I won't say you stop learning, but you're busy with all sorts of things. A Rabbanus in Europe, you took a little position somewhere, unless you were a Rav of a big major city. But a Rav in a small shtetl, learned all day. So you could be a Rav in a place near Slobodka, and you're kind of learning all day, although technically you have a Rabbanus. Rav Yaakov was a Rav in Lithuania, Svitian, before he came to America. So this was Slobodka, and again it was really considered to be after Volozhin. It was considered to be the mother of yeshivas until the Holocaust. Slobodka was a suburb of Kovna. Kovna was the bigger city, and the Rav of Kovna was not in the Hanhalas HaYeshiva itself, but the last Rav of Kovna before the Holocaust was also a great, great gadol. This was Rav Avram Shapiro, and he wrote a sefer called Devar Avram, which is still a sefer that is learned in yeshivas. It's a kind of a yeshivish analysis of many sugyas. Yeah.
The
style or even the street, the Yiddish stories about a town called Kettle, ox. Is that Kettle? Is that the same?
No, no. That's a good point. That's a very good point. Kelem is with a kuf. Kelem. There is a city in Poland called Chelem, or Chelmno, Chelem, and Chelem is a source of many, many folk tales. Chelem is actually a Hasidic city, and the folk tales talk about basically how these were very foolish people, right? The wise men of Chelem always did foolish things, and it became like a source of jokes. But the truth of the matter is, the emes is, Chelem itself was filled with Talmidei Chachamim. It actually was a very learned city. And the Maskilim turned it into a mockery. But it's not Chelem. Chelem is Lithuania. Chelem is Poland. One of the famous stories, though, the Bali Musar themselves would sometimes use a Chelem story to make a point. They tell the story that, in Europe, the minhag was that one of the jobs of the shamish, if you were a shamish of a show, your job was to go around every morning when it was still dark and knock on people's windows and shutters and say, "Shteyuf li avaydas habayre." You have to get up to serve Hashem. That was the shamish's job, to knock at the window. So the story goes in Chelem, that the shamish was getting old and it was hard for him to walk around, but he needed the parnasa. So how could he do his job? So they figured they'll bring all the shutters to the shamish, put it next to his bed, and every morning he can knock on the shutters without having to get out of bed. And they figured this is good for everybody. The shamish gets to do his job, he doesn't have to walk around, and we get to sleep more. So the shamish every morning would stay in bed, but he would knock at the shutters, "Shteyuf, shteyuf, li'avayda sabayvi." So this is one of the jokes they say about the Chachmei Chelem. But the Balei Musar like to say that, you see, it's an important lesson that sometimes the Eibishter is knocking at our door, but nobody's there to listen. Sometimes HaKadosh Baruch Hu finds himself in that predicament. He's knocking and yearning for us to come, but nobody's there, right? So we have to be behind the door to listen. Because Shir Shirim uses the phrase, "Kol Daidi Daifek," the voice of my beloved is knocking. Hashem is knocking. But where are we? We're kind of not there. So they would use that that story as well. Now, let me mention a third. All right, so I mentioned the altar of Kelem, the altar of Slobodka. Let me mention the altar of Nevardik. This is Rav Yosef Yezel Horovitz. Rav Yosef Yezel Horovitz, by the way, this was Rav Chaim Shmulevitz's grandfather. Rav Chaim Shmulevitz's father was the son-in-law of the altar of Nevardik. And Rav Avram Yafin was the other son-in-law of the altar of Nevardik. The altar of Nevardik was a very interesting man. He was orphaned at a young age. And he had many siblings who were younger than him. So, although he was a very bright person, but he basically entered the working world at around the age of 15. He became a merchant and a businessman and a macher and doing all sorts of things. And it is said that one time in his life he met Rav Yisrael Salanter, who was already much older. And he was not a Talmud of Yisrael Salanter. It was like one meeting. And Rav Yisrael Salanter says, "A person like you should learn. You're bright, you're smart, you have a lot of kochos. You should learn. What are you running around with business?" So the person said, in Yiddish, the altar said, "Have to make a living. Machen a living." So Yisrael Salanter said to him, like one phrase, he says, "And how do you prepare for dying? Meaning, do you think about what you're going to take with you when you leave this world?" The altar of Nevardik was apparent. He was already married by the time he had this encounter. So in addition to his siblings, he also had his own mishpacha. But it is said that this one line, sometimes it's one line that just turns you around. In the middle, he was like driving a wagon. In the middle, like he was mafkir the wagon. He left it, and he devoted himself to Torah and Aveda the rest of his life. But there's something here that's very extreme. The altar of Nevardik came to the conclusion that he needed to separate from this world in a very radical way. He had a hut that was built for him. And again, I still don't know all the details how he worked this out with his wife. He may have been a widower at the time, because his wife, I think, died. I think his wife died, and then he made the decision. And he literally locked himself in a room. He didn't leave the room. I mean, I guess he had whatever he needed in the room. And people would bring him food, and there were two holes in the door, one for milchik, one for fleishik. And in Mevardik, he was known as the Baal HaChayrim, the man of the holes. Some people thought he was absolutely crazy. And a lot of the Hisnagdus to Musser said, oh, this is what Musser is. A person locks himself up in a room and people are putting food through the holes. The Rav of Mevardik at the time was none other than the Aruch HaShulchan, who was not a person of the Musser movement, but Aruch HaShulchan was one of the Gedolei HaDor in Psak Halacha. And the Aruch HaShulchan wrote letters saying, leave him alone. He's a tzaddik. He has his avoda. Don't be mafriya him. Some people wanted to break down the house. I mean, again, some kanoim wanted to break down the house because they said a person doesn't have a right. That's not how we serve Hashem. But be it as it may, he became a hermit. He was a hermit. It wasn't extremely long, but I think for a year or 2 years. When he came out of the hermitage, he then, it was almost like this stored up energy. He then went out and established around 120 yeshivas throughout Poland. Yeshiva after yeshiva after yeshiva after yeshiva. The stipler was one of both his talmidim, and the stipler was one of the Rosh yeshiva of a Navardika yeshiva, and the like. 120 yeshivas. The altar, it's hard to summarize what his shita was, but his shita, whatever it was very extreme. Number one, his shita was extreme emuna and bitachon. And his shita was, when you have emuna to the highest level, then you don't need hishtadlus. Hashem will make things happen based on the madrega of your emuna. That's the catch-22. The more emuna you have, the less hishtadlus you need. The less emuna you have, the more hishtadlus you need. So there was, number one, absolute emuna. Number two, and this is really a tight saw of this, never ask yourself, is something possible? Ask yourself if something is desirable. Does Hashem want this to happen? If Hashem wants it to happen, you try to do it, even if it makes no sense and even if it looks impossible. Never ask yourself, can it be done? Ask yourself only, should it be done? And if it should be done, you don't even make any cheshbonus at all. Can it be done or not? That's up to the Ribono Shel Olam. So as a result, the Navardika Talmidim in particular had a very, very strong idea of not being broken. That's why during the Stalinist persecutions, forget about the Holocaust, before the Holocaust, the Navardika yeshivas were located in Stalinist Russia. Unlike Slobodka, Mir, which were in Poland, not under Stalin, Navardik was in the middle of Russia. And they had the koach. In fact, I should mention that the two or three groups that kept Yiddishkeit at least a little bit alive for the 70 years of communist persecution were Chabad. I know that may be a little controversial, but Chabad was operating. Breslev to a smaller degree, and Navardik. Remember, the other yeshivas, Baruch Hashem, were not in Russia. They were outside of Russia. And Navardik had a koach. And because of this, like Rav Simcha Zissel, the Alter of Navardik had his own spiritual exercises, but they were a little different. One of the things he said is that sometimes we don't do what we need to do for Avodas Hashem because we're embarrassed. Right? The first siman in Shulchan Aruch says, don't be embarrassed. So he wanted to break the concept of people being embarrassed. So he had Bukharin go into grocery stores and ask to buy nails or clothes. He says, go into the Makolet, go into the Isaiah Bira Makolet, and say you want to buy a car. Now, what's going to happen is, they'll look at you, and even if they're polite, they won't say anything bad, right? But they're going to think, is this person retarded? Now, I understand there's a problem here. In Slobodka, for example, the altar would say, don't do stupid things. That takes away from the godless Adam. And even without Moshe, someone was like, Chilul Hashem, they're going to think B'nai Torah are crazy. I understand. But the altar said, we have to be Shever the Mida. I'm embarrassed. Learn not to be embarrassed. Don't be ashamed. Even though that's not a mitzvah to ask for a car and a makolet. But you're margil yourself that what people think about me doesn't make a difference. I understand there are chishuvim of Kiddush Hashem, but this is what the altar held, was the tzorech hashoah of the time. And that gave them gevaldik akayach. That's how we did 120 yeshivas in the middle of Stalinist Russia. Unfortunately, Bayrei Olamos u'Machrivan, they got destroyed, but for a while, for 30 years. And then, of course, they came to Eretz Yisrael. Of course, we don't have a whole bunch of Nevardic yeshivas, but the Sharish of that. Now, another example of this, I'll give you an example. There was a big Nevardic yeshiva in France as well, and Rav Gershon Liebman was Rosh Yeshiva, Talmud of the Altar of Nevardic. And he used to come to America to collect money, but he never came with any money at all. Imagine this. He landed at Kennedy Airport, or Idlewild, whatever it was called then. He did not have a penny in his pocket. How is he going to go anywhere? So he came to the airport. His plane landed. And it happened to be a Talmud was in the airport. And the Talmud sees the Rosh Yeshiva. He says, can I take the Rosh Yeshiva somewhere? He says, yeah, Baruch Hashem, you can take where I need to go. He says, I'm very happy to do it. I'm just a little curious. I wasn't even supposed to be here. I mean, if I wouldn't have been here, how would you have gotten around? You don't have any money. He says, you're here, aren't you? I mean, I knew that HaKadosh Baruch Hu would give me this Hatzlacha. Now, Rav Liebman had some problems. You know, one of the problems, this is very bad for a fundraiser. I see that Rav Blum is giving you a shiur in principles of fundraising. Well, what did I say? Oh, second year. Okay. The problem with Rav Liebman was that money made him sick. When he saw money, he vomited. He viscerally could not look at money. So he always had to have somebody with him to collect the money. The idea of being connected to money was so repulsive, he could not even look at it and the like. That was kind of in the Vardic. So they tell the story about the altar of the Vardic himself, to give you an example. And again, I appreciate that this does not so matin to us, but you have to understand at least the koach that's involved here. That there was a certain gevir who was very stingy. He just did not give tzedakah. And nobody, no yeshiva can get any money from him. Nobody was ever successful. The Altar of Nevardic got a big, big donation for Nevardic. So another yeshiva said, you know, Rabbi Yisrael, how did you do it? We've been trying so much, and you somehow come in? So the Altar of Nevardic says, well, tell me, do you behave with Derech Eretz when you come to this guy? He says, of course I do. I come into a beautiful house. I wipe my shoes from the mud. I don't sit down at the furniture that's covered or the sofas that are covered with plastic or whatever it would be. We have Derech Eretz. So she says, oh, so what do you do? He says, oh, I come in, I track mud in the house. I throw my coat, you know, on the table. I put my shoes on the furniture. So why does it work? He says, because when you come in, you show the person that you're machshiv his wealth. You respect his wealth. And then you're asking him to give it up. people don't want to give up that which is so chashuv and so prestigious. I come in and I communicate to the guy, your money is worth nothing at all unless you use it for something good. It's garnished, it's worthless. I'll be doing something for you if you're machzik Torah. So people, the Alter Rebbe says, people don't like to give, but they like to take. I communicate the message that when you give to Torah, you're taking more than you're giving. You're giving the message that he's giving. Right? Again, I'm not saying this the halacha l'maisa in any possible way at all, but Navardik is a fascinating shita because it really is so extreme in many, many ways. Now the emes is, today everything is cholent. You know, there's a slobodka, there's not a kelm, but kelm is kind of in the middle of everything. There's a slobodka, whether it's kevron or slobodka, there's a Navardik. But the truth of the matter is, you don't have pure Navardik anymore, and you don't have pure slobodka anymore. Everything kind of borrows from everything else, so you're not going to have these extremes. But Navardik was a very, very great extreme in emuna, in courage, in doing what you have to do, even if it looks like it's impossible, and then you'll be Zaycha. HaKadosh Baruch Hu will open up tremendous ceiling.